I think you kind of touched on a whole bunch of things there that were really important already. But I want to just drill down into this text that you referred to, Janine, from Leviticus 19. And I want to read it to you and then offer a few thoughts around it. Because this is the text that Jesus quotes when he is asked what's the most important commandment. And he pulls together one from the book of Leviticus and one from the book referred to as Deuteronomy, the second law. And he pulls them together in this unique fashion that scholar Scott McKnight, who was a New Testament scholar, says that this was something unique to Jesus, that there's nothing in the rabbinic literature that sees these two being brought together in the particular way that Jesus brought them into tandem. So we're taking time to dwell upon this first one, and I thought it'd be interesting to return to this context in their scriptures, in the Hebrew scriptures, and indeed the Christian scriptures, those that we have inherited and adopted, and consider what we might learn. So here's the text and the context in which this instruction is given to the Hebrew people. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. You shall not strip your vineyard bare or gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the alien or the foreigner among you. I am the Lord your God. You shall not steal, you shall not deal falsely, and you shall not lie to one another. And you shall not swear falsely by my name, profaning the name of your God. I am the Lord. You shall not defraud your neighbor. You shall not steal. You shall not keep for yourself the wages of a laborer until morning. You shall not revile the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear your God. I am the Lord. Keeping in mind, fear is a word which also means revere, respect, regard. You shall not render an unjust judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. With justice you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go around as a slanderer or slanderer among your people, and you shall not stand idly by when the blood of your neighbor is at stake. I am the Lord. You shall not hate in your heart any one of your kin. You shall reprove your neighbor, or you will incur guilt yourself. You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against any of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. When an alien or a foreigner resides with you in your land, you shall not oppress the foreigner. The foreigner who resides with you shall be to you as native born among you. You shall love the foreigner as yourself. For you were aliens and foreigners in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. You shall not cheat in measuring length, weight, or quantity. You shall have honest balances, honest weights, an honest ephah, and an honest hin. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall keep all my statutes and all my ordinances and observe them. I am the Lord. I find this context fascinating, and I want to offer you just some observations about it. The first is that certainly in the mind and heart of Jesus, but here also within this this list of instructions and this guidance that is given to this company of tribal peoples, neighbor love is to be at the center of their communal relationships. The immediate co-text gives hint to this in a multitude of ways. Loving neighbors is placed here to remind us, and in the teaching of Jesus to remind us, that this is the foundational relational posture. It's the central focus and the overall governing principle of life together. It's the core business for all the people in that community, and by extension in the teaching of Jesus for everyone on planet Earth. So when Jesus identifies this verse as the second most important instruction as its table, but remember, I've sought to help us think about this in a slightly different way, to see it as an ecosystem of love that we are called to inhabit, this great commandment that Jesus gives us. It's something that is put hand in hand with loving God and by implication the loving of self. And the really interesting thing here I find in the text is that the particular example that is given of neighbor, the explicit example is you shall love the alien, the foreigner, as yourself. Because we all know that in life, there are some people that we find easier to love than others. And human beings, as a species, we find it easier to love at least some of our blood relatives, maybe by extension the in-laws. And then others who we form, you know, friendships with. We find, you know, we find a sense of connection with people that we have shared interests and perspectives and values and views with. But here the explicit mention is of those who are the foreigners among you. Love the foreigner, the one who is most unlike you. Not the one you're naturally inclined to love. Not the one who's nice to you. Not the one who is loyal to you. Not those whom you have affection for or natural connection with. But those that there are multiple reasons to be distanced from. So there is this, within the instruction, this call already to love those who sit on the edges. And in the context of that, there's also this the sense that this is going to be a counterforce to all of the unloving, destructive energy that infects the life and health of the community. That grudge-bearing that is mentioned, that hatred towards others, that lack of courage to stand and speak when injustice is occurring. All of these types of things that take place within human communities that prevent the flow of love to neighbour. And the practice of the love of neighbour is to push back against those currents wherever they are occurring, in the home, in the neighbourhood, in the workplace, in the school, in the university campus, in the nation, in the sphere of politics, and begin to let this neighbour love energy arise. The other thing I noticed just about this is that the Israelites are called to consider their own experience as oppressed, marginalized people, and to let those painful memories, even traumatic memories, rather than entrench them into a place of victimhood, into a place which would fuel the fires of vengeance, to move them into a place of compassion towards those who also suffer under the weight of oppression. The alien who resides within you, the scripture here says, shall be to you as native born, and you shall love them as yourself. For you too were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So there's a sense where this is called to be at the heart of all things. I find it fascinating in the New Testament, the text I really struggle with, to be frank, because it's kind of, in Ephesians, where Paul is talking about relationships and intimate relationships, particularly in this in his context of marriage, he gives an instruction to husbands. It's within this patriarchal form, but it says the husband should love his wife as he loves his own body. Love your most intimate neighbor as you would love yourself. And there's an echo of this commandment, even in the context of those relationships within the marriage, within the intimacy of that place. So everywhere we look through Scripture, we find echoes of this. It is to provide the foundation for all kinds of relationships. Because without it, the other types of love that we speak of as human beings will surely fail us. And in this command, we're called to do something which is difficult for many of us, because, among other things, even in our current world, the internal and external pressure is to put ourselves at the center of our own world and insist that others fit comfortably around it. And there's this decentralizing of ourselves that takes place as we seek to work out this command. We're invited to consider how we would like to be loved if we were that neighbor, and to let the insights we gain from that reflection and the emotions that are stirred in empathic response inform us about how we might respond to those neighbors. And it's not as simple as it sounds, because every one of those neighbors has their own unique identity and wiring, don't they? So the first posture is the empty basket that we talk about here. We come not saying, oh yeah, I know what it's like to suffer or to be oppressed or to be marginalized or to be one of the vulnerable ones. I can dig back into my story and see experience and moments when that was me. And I can draw off that to feel my empathy for the person that I'm seeing now. It's much, much more than that. Yes, it entails that. But it's actually having a posture of listening to understand the particular contours of the pain that sit in the other person's life and the ways in which love is able to be received, and then to be able to respond from that place. We ask ourselves what this particular person with their own identity and culture and needs and experiences and indeed often trauma may need from us in order to experience the flow of love towards them. Some of the work that's been done on love languages helps to highlight this. You know, couples talking past each other because, you know, one is wired with words and the other is wired with acts of service, for instance, predominantly. So, you know, one is saying, I'm going to love you by the things I do, and the other one's saying, yeah, but I never hear you say you love me. And I'm not going to feel safe and loved in this relationship unless you learn to speak my language as well. And there is this sense here that the command points us towards this necessity of understanding what it is that enables the other person to be loved. What needs is it that they have that we can respond to? The other big thing I just want to observe from this is that neighbor love flows out of our own experiences of liberating love. The instruction that's given to the people here is a people who have been liberated from oppression and exploitation and injustice and cruelty and murder and potential genocide in Egypt, where the Egyptian pharaoh instructed even that all of the baby boys, as the story narrative unfolds in Egypt, were to be killed. And the story of Moses is one that appears in this kind of context. So there's a genocide that's taking place there that these people have been subjected to. But they've been rescued from this place and brought into the possibility of a new way of being in a new land. And this experience of God's loving liberation is meant to be kept alive in their collective memory and motivate them towards standing alongside others who have had similar experiences, the foreigner in their midst. This is such an important thing. We love because Christ first loved us, is the way the New Testament frames it up. Our experiences of love in the world, which so often get channeled through people in our lives from whom the breath of love comes, or through whom the water of life is given, are the ones that can awaken us to love as well in our own world. Because love doesn't just fall out of the sky, does it? This is why neighbor love. Sometimes there may be experiences that we have that are deeply spiritual or numinous, as some of the authors talk about, where a sense of God's love for us is enfolded into our minds and hearts and bodies. But many people don't have those kinds of experiences in any dramatic form. But we all have little whispers of love that come to us in our life, that come to us through the channel of others, their compassion, their empathy, their kindness, their goodness, their forgiveness, their patience with us. And there is the whisper of God's love through the neighbor, coming to inform us and awaken us to experiences of liberating love. It's amazing, even just the little ways these can find expression. I remember when I was in Auckland, and I think I was probably in my late 20s. Anyway, during the winter, I was going to the gym, and I met a Sikh man. He was from northern India, and we'd chat sometimes in the gym. And then one time we were chatting, and he said, "All right, you and your wife and your children, I think we had two kids at that stage, must come around to my home." And he was the foreigner. He was the one visiting this land. But he said, "You must come around and have a meal, and we can cheer." So we went around to the home, and he had prepared a lovely meal with a very, very, very hot curry. and we sat down, and we just enjoyed his welcome, his hospitality. And this was kind of a reversal, a role reversal. You know, he was the one who extended the invitation to me first, as the one who was a foreigner here in this land. And that was such a beautiful experience of neighbor love, coming from somebody who was a stranger in this land and trying to find his feet as a migrant. One of the things I do remember is our little daughter Bethany discovered his the equipment, his exercise, his gym. And she went over and she was curious about the holes in the bars where you could kind of move the weights up. And she poked her finger into one of those holes and couldn't extract it. So we spent about half an hour of the evening trying to oil up her finger. I had to gently, gently pull this finger out from where it had got jammed. He was very patient with that process. These are sometimes the kinds of experiences where we discover love in unexpected ways, and they come from often the most unexpected people. But neighbor love flows out of our own experience of liberating love, which often comes through the stranger to us. And neighbor love, as this text suggests, is something which pays particular attention to the most vulnerable. Explicitly here, the poor, the alien, those with disabilities, the deaf and the blind are specifically mentioned. These are the ones who sit on the margins. These are the ones who are most vulnerable. And the Hebrew people are instructed to develop farming practices or economic practices that ensure these people are provided for. So this concern is not just personal, because this book isn't given to individuals. It's given to a community, a tribal community, with instructions about how to order their life together. But they have to develop these practices to ensure that the poor are provided for communally. So it wasn't just going to rely on individual people feeling motivated to do something loving. Every farmer in the land knew that this was the expectation and the law, that when you harvested your crop, you would leave some of that harvest for the poor and the foreigner. You wouldn't reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. You wouldn't strip it bare, maximize your profit, but you would actually create a system that ensured the poor were provided for. I think my experience in a lot of Christian churches has been this kind of emphasis on individual morality and piety and spirituality. But here, this is a communal ownership of this is the kind of people we will be, and this is the way we will shape our life together to ensure that the poor are cared for. It's anchored in the soil of our lives. It's deeply practical. That's why in 1 John 3:18 in the New Testament, you have John saying things like, "Dear children, let's not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth." Let's get it grounded. Let's get it anchored in the soil of our lives. Practices that we encourage each other into and share together that give expression to neighbour love. I love what the Addington farmer's doing, incidentally, to Wairinga. And I love what they're doing with the veggie bags. Wilby's not here this morning, is he? Wilby, where are you? Come up here. Just so this is an initiative, a group of people who are seeking to give expression to how they love their neighbors, literally with food, and took a big risk just recently in working cooperatively with City Council to acquire some land. So among other things, the poor can be provided for. So tell us a little bit about it and the veggie bags. Is a chance for a plug.
So essentially it's a koha veggie bag, so people can pay what they can. A lot of the veggies, though, never make it into a bag, especially at the moment. Lots of people are coming most days of the week and helping themselves, and a lot of the time it works quite well. A lot of the time it's a bit messy. Not everybody likes to harvest in the way that other people like to harvest. So when I hear the scriptures this morning, it's actually really messy, eh? It's so messy when people try to cultivate, I guess you call it almost like a commons environment where everybody can participate and share in the reward. If you're interested in veggies, we've got a veggie bag. It's koha. And the idea is that those who can't afford veggies can still get some veggies, but those who may be more financially comfortable can pay more. And so there's not like a strict requirement that people pay a certain amount. That's all, I guess. Unless there's other questions for you, Sean.
Yeah, that's really, really helpful. Yeah. We'll hear some more about that at another time, This is literally an initiative which is seeking, among other things, to address the needs of the poor and the marginalised in the community and provide for them what is vital to their life and their well-being. Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, once said that, I really only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. And this is kind of part of the invitation here within this. Where are the people in our world who are the most vulnerable? The people in our family, workplace and school and neighbourhood. And the people who are treated with the least regard and the least respect and the least kindness, the people who are viewed suspiciously or just can't find a place for whatever reason because they don't fit the norm that the tribe expects. And here there's this invitation to respond, to identify those people and respond particularly with love towards them. I love some of the other initiatives in our life together around what's being done with refugees. And some of that's involved political action as well, having to write letters. Some of our team, Fern and Anna and Andrea, who else? There's a whole group of you, Karen involved, and Jeff, Claire, who have been over the last few years supporting Muhammad and Hamid. The work that's been done there is work that's also having to engage in the political sphere, advocating on behalf of migrants in multiple ways, because it's a system that often seems the antithesis of neighbour love. And this is something that this text invites us to consider too. If this is a communal responsibility, what does it mean for the systems, including the political systems and those who sit within them, to work our lives in ways and to act in ways that are going to help to have influence there? So I just find this text has an enormous amount of invitation to us. It's something which can stir us towards nuances of neighbour love that we might not have caught sight of before. And neighbours always have a name and a face. You know, there's Danny, or there's Adrian, or there's Muhammad, or there's Hamid, or there's someone else. I went home last week and Jill said to me, she said, I noticed an ambulance pull up in the street next to one of our neighbours. And she said, I didn't want to be intrusive, but I just felt I needed to go over and see what was happening and see if people were okay. And one of our neighbours, sadly, had an elderly woman had passed away during the night. A Romanian migrant who spoke no English, lived with her daughter. And so there was a little bit of Incidentally, she told me that, her husband told me that the Romanian Orthodox Church, or the Eastern Orthodox Church that they attend here, has 3-hour Sunday services. So, you know, if you think ours are long, okay. But, so Jill went back and our granddaughter Lydia was coming over. She's just started school for during the holidays for a couple of days. So they got together and they did some baking and they took it over to her, to the family. Just a simple thing that can be done to observe and be alert to the lives of people around us and respond as best we can in ways that hopefully are going to communicate love and validate and their importance as those who are doing life together with us in this place. This is the invitation, I think, from this text. This sense of responding to Jesus' call to integrate this into this ecosystem of love that we build into our lives. Thanks, Jenny.